This is the Spark My Muse podcast with me, your host, Lisa DeLay. Hello, friends and listeners. Welcome to episode 10 of Spark My Muse. It's great to have you along. And today's episode, we'll be talking about wine headaches, which are great to avoid. And we'll be chatting with Emily Miller, who is a reporter and journalist for the Chicago Sun-Times. She handles all their social media entries. And she also is a regular contributor to Relevant Magazine. She wrote an article called Four Churches That Are Changing the World, and it's a very positive article that can be very inspiring for us. Sometimes we only hear bad news, and it's great to hear from Emily, and I think you'll really enjoy the show. So for today's wine segment, have you ever gotten a wine headache? Some people come in and they tell me, I can't drink red wine. It gives me a headache. So wine headaches start because red wine, more than white wine, the red grapes, also called noir grapes. In French, there's two kinds of grapes. There's blanc, which is white grapes, which tend to be green. And then there's noir. And noir grapes are black grapes, but really they're a whole range of reds, purples, almost blackish grapes that are so purple that they're black, almost black looking. And on the skins of red grapes, there are histamines, and people are allergic to histamines, and that's why you can take an antihistamine, which might be a good recommendation to take maybe a half dose of a histamine if you're going to drink red wine, or just stay away from it altogether. And then white wine has a little less histamines. Some people think that they get wine headaches because they're allergic to sulfur. There's a lot of labeling on wine bottles now. The US government has mandated that wine be labeled contains sulfates. Well, all wine contains sulfates because it's natural in the fermenting process. And also sulfates are added to speed up the fermenting process and kill bacteria and keep things clean and efficient. But there really are not more sulfates, which is sulfur dioxide and sulfur derivatives in wine than there have been in the past. It's negligible, the amount of difference. But really, there's only 1% of the population who is truly allergic to sulfates. So you're not getting a headache. If you're getting a headache, it's not because of the sulfates. Very unlikely that it is. Another thing to do to avoid headaches is try to have a 1-to-1 ratio with a 5-ounce glass of wine. Also have 5 ounces of water. Dehydration can cause some nasty headaches, and we can get into those situations where we're just not drinking enough water, and then we get a headache, maybe even a migraine. So some other facts about wine. Is wine fattening? A lot of people want to know. People know beer is fattening, and that is because there's a lot of carbohydrates in beer. Essentially, the healthiest, most low-calorie wine you can have is a dry red. A dry red wine doesn't have a high residual sugar, and so it's not as sweet, of course. And it also has more healthful benefits. The skins of the grapes contain a lot of antioxidants that have a lot of health benefits, including preventing cancer. So a dry red wine, one glass a day, is actually very healthy for you, especially compared to drinking something like beer or soda. It's way more healthy. Here are some other facts. A case of wine is 12 bottles of wine and approximately 48 glasses of wine. Essentially, there are just a little over 25 ounces in each bottle. And you should be able to get 4 to 5 glasses out of each bottle, unless you're overpouring, which is kind of the crime everybody is guilty of. And it takes 30 pounds of grapes to make one case of wine. That's quite a lot of grapes. You get about 2.8 pounds per vine of grapes, and that makes one bottle of wine. I did a Google Hangouts with Emily, and I have to apologize that the quality of video is not very good. It has a lot of digital weirdness about it, but I hope you'll persevere through it and listen to it. It's interesting what Emily has to say. I started chatting with her about her article, and we go into some of that. I want to encourage you to look at the show notes for this episode, because you'll find a lot of important links to her work and the charity she's involved with First Nations. Enjoy the interview. Some of the surprises you noticed in researching for your article about four churches that are changing the world.
So yeah, my article in the most recent issue of Relevant Magazine is Four Churches Changing Everything. Something about, you know, white in the church, and I was like, that, I'll do that one. I mean, after a while, you start to hear much the church could be doing better and everything, you can kind of lose sight of the fact that live in the world and still doing really amazing. So it was great to just kind of, I went on my Facebook page then as a first step and was just like, hey guys, tell me about your churches, what they're doing, other churches are doing inspiring things. And I think one of the biggest surprises for me was just how many people had ideas of I've heard about this church, I go to this church, and just the door that opened. It wasn't like, and by churches doing things right, I mean this one thing. I mean, there were so many different things. There were churches that were engaging creativity, were trying to engage their whole neighborhood. There were churches that were, you know, really paying attention to their demographics and making sure that, you know, it wasn't just 90% of churches are 90% all one race. And there are churches that are being really intentional about that, about making sure that that's not the case in their congregation. So it was just the variety of churches and the variety of things that they're doing. Some were small, some were progressive, some were old, some were new, some were conservative. You know, some were really huge mega churches. So it was just that variety was surprising, and how much other people really said they needed to hear some good news about the church too. Because I know I take in a lot of negative information all the time because I work on the internet for a living, and you know, I'm a journalist, and so you get the good with the bad and everything.
Your work brought to mind that our job as creatives is also to tell the truth that is good news too, not just pointing out things that need to change, but also highlighting those hopeful things so we can be encouraged to continue doing good and doing good work.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, all of those conversations are important. I'm not saying, you know, most of my work is just being down on the church or that there isn't a place for having these discussions, because I think it's really important to, you know, take an honest look as Christians at what we're doing and what our churches are doing and, you know, that message that we're putting out there in the world and who we are being to the world. And, you know, being willing to take a good hard look at that and have discussions about what we could be doing better and hearing from people we don't normally hear from in the church and how we can be loving them better and being more welcoming to them. So I think all of those conversations have been really important. But I think you are missing a piece if you don't talk about the fact that good things are happening too, just to get the full story and the full breadth of what's happening in the church today. Why is so much of the news that we hear in the media negative? One of the first things you learn in journalism school is, well, what's newsworthy? It's not dog bites man that happens all the time. But if a man bites a dog, that's newsworthy because that's not something you're used to seeing. And so I think one of the things that's, you know, even as you see so many negative headlines about the church, one of the things that's encouraging within that is that that's still news, that we still assume that the church is a good place and is a force for good, that when bad things happen, it surprises us, that's newsworthy. So I guess that would be kind of why you hear negative news and like a little piece of good news that's like buried within that bad news.
Right. That's a really good point. So I was kind of interested to hear from you about a church that doesn't get any press or that, you know, would never really be in the spotlight, and what you learned from them and something that we could take away as inspiration.
One of the churches that I talked to was this Galileo Field, Texas, and they're a really new church. I want to say they're about a year old, and they're really small. They have, I think when I talked to them, maybe 50 members. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's a church you wouldn't hear a lot about. They're not a big mega church. They're not in a big city. They're in like a suburb in Texas. But I thought what they were doing was so interesting. Their home, the church, is welcoming the spiritual refugees. So the pastor there, her name is Katie Hayes, and she had this great quote that you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody in Texas who hasn't heard of Jesus, but there are lots of people who think Jesus isn't for them. And so their mission has been to go out and to just let everybody know that, no, Jesus is for them, church is for them, they're here for them. And so they've reached out to the LGBT community in their area. They've reached out, there's a lot of affluent suburbs there, and so they've reached out to the people who are doing the less glorious affluent work. They take cookies to people who are working, you know, in restaurants or at like a hair salon and stuff like that on holidays, just to let people know that, you know, they're thinking of them, they're welcoming them, they're not forgotten. And they've got an interesting commitment to, you know, creating a space that and embracing beauty, because that's a part of who God is. It's just really interesting to hear what they're doing, because it's a small church in a small town, and you wouldn't otherwise hear about them, but they're doing some interesting things there.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it's not like we're going to church looks so different depending on where you are. You know, you were highlighting the Mosaic Church in LA, and that is vastly, it couldn't be probably more different. and it really needs to be different because it's in a huge city.
Yeah, that Galileo had talked about was they have a commitment to being a small church, that, you know, a lot of churches might be wanting to bring more people through the doors, and that's not necessarily what they want to do. They want to keep it small. They want to keep it really intimate so they can really pour into relationships with people. And they even sort of emphasize their small groups throughout the week more than what they're doing at church on Sunday, as like living out those real relationships with people. Because they say, you know, church is a really sort of intimate act to share with people. And, you know, they want to get to know people and everything before they sort of invite them to take part in something that is so intimate and can be so uncomfortable. So I just thought that was really interesting. Given the opportunity to be a mega church, that wasn't something that they were even interested in.
Yeah, that is really powerful too, because I think we are talking about building deep bonds with people that, you know, in an age where everybody's sort of connected, but it's only like an inch deep, a lot of times. And then church can be like that too. And you can just kind of be on the periphery, but those deep, intimate friendships are what come out during, if someone's really suffering or if someone's having a hard time or going through something, then they can feel very alone in a church that hasn't made those really important relational connections. But it does bring up the point that, so what happens when they're successful and they get to be 200, like, do they then have a sister church? Did that come up in your conversation with them?
You know, it was a couple months ago now when I when I interviewed them, I don't remember them talking about like what the plan is then. And I'm not sure if they have a plan for when that happens. Right. I think it's so new and so small. It's like, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So it'd be interesting to see what would happen then. How do you honor that commitment to being small if you get big, if enough people respond?
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of what you were talking about with people really wanting those connections. That's something that you see statistically. I was looking at a lot of the Barna data they've been over the past decade studying like millennials in the church. And that's something that millennials are really looking for in church, that people, like millennial people who stay in the church, one of the factors that they're citing with why they've stayed, why they haven't left, is because they have had those deep relationships with adults and other people in the church. And I hate to always cast millennials as this like monolithic, yeah, we all think thing. But I mean, statistically, that's one of the answers that they had gotten from most millennials. That this is a reason why they were continuing to come to church. When the numbers show 6 in 10 at some point will leave the church for at least some time in the first decade of adulthood.
Yeah, and you know, my church, I want to ask you about where do you go to church and what it's like, because you're in the Chicago area. And briefly, the church that I go to has had a big resurgence with millennials, which is now, of course, the biggest demographic in the United States. And it's mostly young families with babies, and you know, just a couple and then a child, and they seem to want to come back for their children. And it's really neat to see them. I don't know that we're totally connecting with them quite yet, unless it's related somehow to their children. But our church is about like just over 200, 220 or something like that. And we had a dip for a while. And now it's really fascinating because there's probably 8 to 10 new families coming in, but they're all under 32, 33 years old. So it's been fascinating to see that uptick.
Yeah. Well, for me, I actually had a really hard time finding a church when I first moved back to Chicago. My family's originally from the Chicago area, and we moved downstate when I was in grade school, and we always went to Lutheran churches. We were ELCA, so the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Mm-hmm. And when I went to college, I was kind of thinking, oh, I really want to make my faith my own, I think is, you know, most people do when they go to college. And so I went to this church that was kind of like a big mega church, you know, like the big screens and the fill in the blanks in your programs and everything. I really loved about that church was the connection, was the fact that they had small groups, and that in our small groups we really connected and did life together. Mm. And when I moved back to Chicago, one of the things I had missed going to that church was the liturgy that I grew up with. Just as a rite, just the words and the tradition of the liturgy, that's something that just really connects with me. And so I wanted to find a church that was liturgical. You know, young people my age that I could really connect and go deep with, was so hard, was finding a church that had both of those things. And it took me a year or two of church shopping on Sunday mornings to really find a church like that. For a while, I was going to two different churches. I would go to an Episcopal church in the morning, and then small at another like Chicago area mega church, you know, throughout the week. But the church that I go to now, it's called Covenant Presbyterian. And this is something that they do both of these things extremely well. We have very, very liturgical. The music is amazing. It's all these old hymns, but they're kind of given a new sort of bluegrassy spin. Mm-hmm. Which I adore. And then during the weeks, I mean, we have a lot of small groups. We really connect. We do, you know, we give back to the neighborhood. We get involved with different ministries in Chicago. So it took a while to find all of those things in one place. But I'm really glad to have found that now.
Yeah, that's really neat. I know it can be a real journey sometimes till you find something. And I think that it certainly isn't just millennials who need that connection. At least I know that I do too, like actually feeling like you could spend time outside of church with people and do other things. And it can be hard because people are busy with work and stuff, but then, you know, people who are I'm older than you a little bit, and so it's kind of like soccer practice, karate, and and by the time that happens, nobody can like actually have any downtime. And so I'm kind of wondering too. I like to ask, because you're a creative person and you're constantly creating, is it those friendships that spark your muse the most, or what are the things that inspire you as you're creating?
Well, it's a lot of the conversations that I have with people. And for being a journalist, I think when you're in journalism school, or maybe when I was in journalism school, or you're kind of new as a journalist, you think you're going to write all of these words that are going to like change the way people think about things, and you're really going to impact them. And what I found in nearly a decade as a journalist now is that the conversations that I have with people have changed me so much more than I would assume that the articles I've written out of them have changed other people reading them. It's just, you get to hear from so many different people, from so many different backgrounds and belief systems, and you know, physical places where they live. It just really has opened me up to, you know, seeing things from other people's point of view. And really, if I want people to respect my beliefs, well, it goes back to the golden rule of treating people as you'd like to be treated. And so when I think about, well, how would I want someone to represent me or my religious beliefs, it's a reminder to me to respect them in the way that I present all of their beliefs. So it's really helped me to see things from other people's points of view, and to be able to just be able to share more objectively. And really, I've kind of come away from, you have to write an article that just makes this one point and that everybody should think this way. And really, I'd rather just gather so many different voices together in conversation, and kind of have an article be a conversation starter where if you're interested in a topic, you can read it, you can hear from all these different viewpoints, and then, you know, you'll have the tools to have those conversations of your own with people, or to just be able to think through a lot of those topics and hear from, you know, other perspectives you might not have thought of.
Yeah, and that's a really judicious, like, ethical approach too, because I know that people are especially increasingly skeptical because they see, in journalism, sometimes they see people have an angle and it's pretty obvious what the angle is. But when you present something fully, and you can see, okay, there's some good on this, and then there's some bad, or there's some stuff I can agree with, and there's some stuff I can disagree with, but I can come to my own conclusion, then it actually can. It's that's actually the educational value of what you're doing. And I think, I mean, do you find who else does that you admire?
Gosh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. There's some really good journalists out there who are just reporting religion news and doing it well and giving you a good sense of story. One of them is Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who actually, she's at the Washington Post now. They just launched a new faith vertical. And I think, and she does a really amazing job. And what's funny is she was the intern at the suburban Chicago newspaper before I was the intern there. So I feel like, so I've kind of been, you know, we've kind of been like following each other's careers this whole time.
Wow.
So really cool to see the work that she's been doing. But I think that she does a really outstanding job. I really love, the Boston Globe launched a vertical just about Catholicism, not that long ago, called Crux. And I really enjoy the work that they're doing there too. I mean, it's good, it's in-depth reporting on Catholicism, but they'll mix in like a quiz, like, you know, how well do you know Pope Francis and things like that, just like fun things. So I feel like that it's good, straightforward reporting, you know, that you can take that and draw your own conclusions from. But they also get kind of the digital culture and having a, you know, running a website where you, you have to engage all those things. The people who are looking for a fun quiz, as well as the people who are really looking for breaking news, as well as, you know, more of a in-depth look at different sides of issues.
Yeah, it's like the Cosmo quiz meets the, like, but yeah, and another hero of mine recently, I guess in the last year, although she's not journalism per se, but is Krista Tippett, who's doing On Being, and I'm just a huge fan of the show, but she's really fascinating because she really brings people from very diverse backgrounds, and you can tell that she, and she's really open about her background being fundamentalist at first in childhood, and then I believe Methodist. She has her Master of Divinity, and so she has this whole breadth of experience and knowledge, and you know the seminary credentials too, but also appreciates other traditions. But interestingly, you can tell though what she's like a huge fan, like you could tell she's a Christian sometimes because of the excitement in her voice when she asks questions. And I notice she's so fair to everyone. But when she had Jean Vanier, the Daybreak director of Daybreak, she was like fanning out, like she was so tickled. She's like, people have called you a living saint, and you're thinking, you probably called him a living saint. You're so excited, but it's a, I really appreciate the show because I do have a more of an ecumenical bent to me and how I like to approach things. But she's kind of the person who gives everybody, even the secular atheist, the chance to talk about some of those deeper things. Is there anything you're working on now that would be interesting to come up in a future episode?
Right now, the main thing I'm working on the side, I run a nonprofit now up on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota, and we do these Hope Day camps in the summer, and I'm actually, most of what I'm doing right now is kind of gearing up for all of our summer work up there, so I'm writing our training manual, and I'm actually driving to Nebraska later today to lead our first training for a team from a church there who's going to come and lead one of the camps, or actually two of the camps. So I've been working on the training manuals and, you know, getting our website updated and some other things coming up this summer with that. So that's where most of my writing energies are going right now. So that's the next big thing. That'll be my summer.
Yeah, that'll be neat. I'll include a link to that, to the White Earth people, correct?
Yes, the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Our nonprofit is called Hope for the First Nations.
Good. Yeah, I did look them up, and I will include that in show notes for this episode. I'm not sure when it'll air, but probably in about 3 weeks or so, and then hopefully people can kind of find out what you're doing with that, and that would be really neat to spread the word about that. That's kind of broadcasted mission field for sure.
Yeah, and it's not something that I've talked or written a lot about, but it's something that's been a huge part of my life. That, you know, a lot of I end up spending a lot of time and energy toward our work there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just became president this past
year. That's right. Yeah, that's definitely a boost. Does that mean you'll have to give up something else that you're working on, or you can fit it in?
Well, so far, so good. Another thing that I've been doing a lot of lately is I've just been doing a lot more reporting for the Sun-Times, where I work. My day job is running our social media, but I've kind of been keeping an eye on the religion beat there, just because we've had so much news in the past month. The cardinal here in Chicago died. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of news there to cover. And the new archbishop He's been here less than a year. He's been kind of going around and doing, you know, his getting to know you tour with the media here and everything. So there are a few stories there. Which Chicago, the Archdiocese of Chicago is 2.2 million Catholics. So it's a, it's a huge audience. And so we cover quite heavy at the paper. So that's something I've been doing more of and been really enjoying getting back into, you know, reporting for the paper, which is something I haven't done as much of since I started doing our social media. Yeah. So that's another thing I've been doing a lot of that I've been really excited about. So I've been doing, yeah, doing a lot of writing there and then a lot of work for the nonprofit in the evenings in my spare time.
Well, I'll probably wrap it up here. It's been great, and I don't want to keep you since you have to travel soon, pretty far. I don't know how many hours that is, but it doesn't sound that close by, right?
Nebraska?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's like 8 hours from Chicago to Lincoln.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's serious time. So. But I am just really grateful that you could come on and talk with me for a little while. And it was really neat. And you're always kind of up to something that I like to keep track of you. I wind up going to Relevant and like, okay, what's she write now? So.
Yeah, the great thing with journalism is that it's always something new.
Yes. All right. Have a great day, Emily. I'll talk to you soon.